This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on location today in Las Vegas, and we're with poet David Wagoner, who is one of America's great poets. And we've got him to ourselves for an hour, and he's going to open with an opening poem.
My father's dance. He thought of his body sometimes when he had to, as something to go to work with, then bring back, wash off, cover up, and forget about as soon as possible till it went on the next shift. At home he played old songs on the piano and sang them, swaying on the bench to Nola and Piccolo Pete and hitting the lowest notes of the bells in the lighthouse and asleep in the deep. After years of working at it, he gave up, wanting to be invisible in public, but still didn't like being noticed. He'd sit in the back, or better yet, would stand back near the door, just in case. But that was only in halls where the lights stayed on. If it was going to be dark, he'd usher us and his body down the aisle to the best seats he could find up near the stage and forget himself. I'd watch his face come alive and the light of joy go dancing across his glasses as hoofers like Ebsen Bulger or Bojangles carried him away on the tips of their toes. In all his 80-odd years, he never once would take a first shy step on a dance floor, which is any floor anywhere, or broken concrete, or dirt, or water, or air, if you trust the music. But now he's going to. Here, in my lifetime, I'm nearly in sole charge of his memory and the heavy ghost of his body. I'm leading it out onto this floor and saying, dance.
The voice of David Wagoner, who's in sole charge of memory today. And we're on location. I'm Grace Cavalieri. That is from a new manuscript. We may be the first people to hear it.
Yes.
And what is the title of that manuscript going to be?
I believe it's going to be Up and Around. Unless I think of a better one.
And what is that? How do you compare that with the kind of work you've done for all these years?
Well, it seems to be more or less of the same order. It's maybe less rigid than I was at the beginning. But I camped out my territory fairly early, it would seem, and I keep recognizing these categories that show up as I organize a book.
And what are those categories?
Well, let me think. Well, there are the autobiographical ones, the ones about literary matters, the writing of poetry, the teaching of poetry, the lives of other writers. Then there is, I've written an awful lot for some reason about, I guess you could call it war. There are lots of poems about the complications of being a soldier, which I never was. I was in the Navy. And then there are poems about animals in their various disguises and roles, both in the zoo and in the wild. And then there are poems about, well, I guess what you'd call the natural world, as you did a moment ago, and my place in it, including its landscapes and their effect on me. And lastly, I must call them, they're satiric. They're often about social matters.
It seems to me that when you came along in poetry, you contributed what we call the domestic imagination to poetry. We had T.S. Eliot, who saw the Holy Grail. Remember, James Dickey thought of himself as the great heroic poet. And into that, you introduced the man in the kitchen, the man walking around the lawn, the man in his home, and took the poet to a different place in our society, and with that, a new nobility. Are you aware of that?
No, I am not. I am aware that I use more than one voice. And I don't know what this is. This makes some people uneasy in poetry. Young poets are frequently told to find their own voices, but they don't. But those who tell them that frequently don't mean the plural. They are speaking about an individual voice that they must develop and adhere to. I have always admired W.H. Auden, who used how many voices? I'm not sure. Dozens.
Well, let's talk about your voices, because I don't think the general public knows all that you have done.
Well, I use sometimes the voice of authority, which is not my own, in order to mock it or to use it for satiric purposes, at any rate. I have heard... I tend toward trying to use the commonplace, mm-hmm. to use the conversational, both rhythmically and in diction, to simplify rather than complicate, though I once in a while try that. I fly off the handle and allow myself to as much as I possibly can. But I remember friends of mine were very disappointed in a Picasso show in Paris because he had, I think it was 16 or 18 portraits of one of his mistresses done in styles all the way from the Renaissance to Cubism. And they felt that there was no real Picasso, that he could, because he could paint any way at all, that he was deceiving them, or that this was some sort of failure on his part. For me, I that was a cause of nothing but admiration.
And that is what we want to say and point out about your own work, because you are a fiction writer, a novelist, a dramatist. You have written for a film which Francis Ford Coppola produced. You have written essays. You have taught. I think that you have ventured into every literary genre, and we're going to talk about a little bit of those today. We're at a program called The Poet and the Poem, and we're in Las Vegas on location, where David will be addressing 4,000 people at a poetry convention today. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and this is who he is. He was born in Ohio, raised in Indiana. Went to the University of Pennsylvania?
Penn State.
Well, I knew it was in Pennsylvania. And actually began teaching there at some point.
Yeah.
Yes. And then you went to the University of Washington around 1954?
54.
And that really began, you really were a meteor in the sky then. We won't belabor your attention to Ted Retke, who was your teacher, I think, at Penn.
Yeah.
But I know you went to the University of Washington to join him. And did you get there after he died, or did you work with him before he died?
I was his colleague for 10 years at the University of Washington. Mm-hmm. He got me my job there.
As a teaching assistant, right?
No, I
professor?
Was...
Professor?
I started as an instructor for mm-hmm. 1 year, then assistant professor, then associate professor, and then from 1966 on, full professor.
And how long did you stay at the University of Washington?
Oh, gosh. 50 years.
Is it?
Yes.
Oh, did you retire yet?
Yes, I've retired from there.
Okay. This is The Poet and the Poem. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and you're going to be listening to the poetry of David Wagoner. David, I think that when a poet, the miracle is that a poet can write a book or a poem so many years ago, and the reverberation of that poem can go on without the poet knowing it. And I think that that is so cool. And I'm talking about Salmon Boy. You know that it's a much-loved poem, yes?
Well, I know it's fun to read because it's a voice I don't get to use very often. The Indian storytellers were very blunt, and they used short sentences and uncomplicated syntax and vivid imagery. And I enjoy all of those when I can, at least out loud.
So you took a story that was already existing. It was a myth or a legend,
yes.
An Indian. Was it a Northwest myth?
It was, or it still is, a literal translation of an Indian storyteller. The Bureau of American Ethnology texts from most libraries have them. But the Northwest Indian tales had been neglected or underestimated, I think. And the idea of the noble savage who didn't know really what anything complicated was soon disappeared when I read these translations by students of Franz Boas.
This poem, Salmon Boy, was recently used at an educational convention of poets.
News to me.
I know. That's why I'm here to tell you. It was presented by the very fine poet and spiritual leader David White, from a Welsh-Irish poet, who sees the story, the great myth of the heroic journey of the young man to his rites of passage and to his final conclusion. And so we're going to hear that poem and talk a little bit about it. It is said that you are part shaman, part poet, part magician. And we're going to hear the poet part right now with this beautiful poem, Salmon Boy.
That boy was hungry. His mother gave him dog salmon, only the head. It was not enough. And he carried it hungry to the river's mouth and fell down hungry. Salt water came from his eyes, and he turned over and over. He turned into it. And that boy was swimming under the water with his round eyes open. He could not close them. He was breathing the river through his mouth. The river's mouth was in his mouth. He saw stones shimmering under him. Now he was Salmon Boy. He saw the salmon people waiting. They said, "This water is our wind. We are tired of swimming against the wind. Come to the deep, calm valley of the sea. We are hungry too. We must find the herring people." And they turned their green tails. Salmon Boy followed. He saw a shell walking backward, woman who was half stone. He heard the long, high howling of wolf whale, seal woman's laughter, the whistling of sea snake. Saw a loon mother flying through branches of seaweed. Felt changer turn over far down in his sleep. He followed to the edge of the sky where it opens and closes, where moon opens and closes forever. And the herring people brought feasts of eggs, and as many as stars. And Salmon Boy ate the stars as if he flew among them, saying, "Hungry, hungry." But the post of heaven shook, and the rain fell like pieces of moon, and the salmon people swam, tasting sweet, saltless wind under the water, opening their mouths again to the river's mouth. And Salmon Boy followed, full-bellied, not afraid. He swam fastest of all. He leaped into the air and smacked his blue-green silvery side, crying, "Ayo, I jump," again and again. Oh, he was Salmon Boy. He could breathe everything. He could see everything. He could eat everything. And then his father speared him. He lay on the river bank with his eyes open, saying nothing, while his father emptied his belly. He said nothing when his mother opened him wide to dry in the sun. He was full of the sun. All day he dried on sticks, staring upriver.
That's the voice of David Wagoner and the poem Salmon Boy. I'm Grace Cavalieri. This has been talked about in relation to Joseph Campbell and the myth of the hero. And in this case, throughout legend and myth, we have the young man who has to overcome his father's wounds, really, and maybe even kill the father to become who he is. We have different versions of that. And in this one, he has his moment before the unknowing spear. And his moment, he is full-bellied and unafraid. And this is the moment we seek. And this is the moment we want for young people. And I think that's why David White uses you in teaching, because it is not the spearing at the end, and it is not the repression at the beginning. It is that moment where we can become the artist. We can be full-bellied and unafraid.
That seems right to me, too. It is the apotheosis of the hero, and he becomes food for all the people thereafter, as heroic figures can and have in the past.
I think that I want to pass on a universal thank you for that poem. And many people have remarked about it. I think you're going to read it to 4,000 people this weekend, and we'll see what they think.
I may not know what they think, but I'll be glad to show off.
And you have been memorializing your own father, so we know you were not speared mortally anyway.
Well, he was a very puzzling figure, and I know most people feel this way about their fathers, but mine was a particularly strange example. He had a degree, he's a very good football player, and he played against Jim Thorpe, among others. He had a degree, magna cum laude, in classical languages, and he worked all his life in a steel mill because he was too shy to teach. He was offered a job teaching an assistant coaching in football at BMI, but he couldn't take it. I don't know how he felt about me. It was an odd relationship. He never said one word to me about my writing, though he read my books, at least a dozen of them.
He lived to see you well published.
Then. Oh, yes. He lived into his 80s. He died in the middle 1970s. And, I've been trying to figure him out ever since. There are a lot more complications to it.
Is this manuscript going to do it?
I don't know. I've been doing it little by little, like a number of other poets. I doubt whether there is a poet who hasn't written a poem about his, her father and mother, even if they're in disguise, as they are in Yeats.
Let us have another poem.
Okay.
We're at a convention in Las Vegas, and David Wagner is one of the featured poets, along with W.D. Snodgrass and a couple other luminaries, but this is our moment with David.
Well, this poem's called A Cold Call. Anybody who's ever had to deal with salesmen knows what that means. It means you don't have any preparation for dealing with a potential customer. You just have to talk off the top of your head. Closely related to a cold reading by a fortune teller. Well, anyway, a cold call. Holly is calling me from the cemetery. She wants to plot my future. She really wants me to be considerate of my loved ones in advance, to make all the arrangements now so none of them will have to feel the expensive thrill of it at the wrong time. And she can make a place for me all at once over the phone and spare every one of us our pain and awkwardness. The facilities I wouldn't believe. They're in a sylvan setting, which means it's like under trees, with a very tasteful horizontal stone, so the grass around it can be moved off of my name and dates, and a 12 or under letter characterization engraved there, such as dearest, or husband, or sergeant, or beloved. Would be visibly permanent regardless of growth. She's offering today what she won't call a once-in-a-lifetime discount, but let's face it, it sort of is.
And you are known for your humor as well, David Wagner. Along with your poetry, you're an award-winning fiction writer. I think your first, let me think if I have your first book here, that was like 1953 or something, The Middleman?
Oh, The Man in the Middle.
The Man in the Middle. And then Money, Money?
Money, Money, Money.
Yeah.
It's a quotation from Röttgen. Money, 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 Water, Water, Water.
And you went on to write how many books of fiction?
I published 10 novels, though I wrote more than 20.
And how is that energy different from writing the poem? Because you put out books the same time, sometime the same years.
Yes, I turned to fiction because I got encouraged early, I think, and I never knew what I could do, really, and I wasn't nearly as good at it as at poetry, though, you know, if they start publishing your novels, you're tempted to write another one, and I remember my editors say, when they took the first one, after it had been to 16 publishers, Harcourt Brace took it, and I was so pleased and so energized, I wrote another one. And they accepted that before they published the first one. And my editor said that was the first time she ever knew of anybody doing that.
And then we're going to leap forward to 1966. The book Staying Alive was considered actually a major noteworthy event. Are you aware of that?
Well, yes. A number of reviewers or critics have talked that way. I think it was a real step forward for me. it got a good deal of attention, and I was grateful for that. It was very encouraging.
And you also got an award from the National Institute of Arts and Letters that year.
Yes.
And became editor of Poetry Northwest.
Yes. All of those sort of ganged up on me. I went on till the end of Poetry Northwest, 36 or 8 years. I forgot. I've lost track. I think it's 36 years later.
And that became one of the most significant small magazines in America.
Ooh.
Which began with the small magazine movement. I think it gained momentum in the 60s. I've been following it well. Reed Whittemore in the 40s with Furioso, and then the Carlton Review, and the small magazine really was what online poetry is about now, distribution. And then you came along with Poetry Northwest, and it was a high water mark. And I remember that we all read that because of your choices of poems.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I hasten to add that Carolyn Kaiser started the magazine in 1959, and that I took over in 1966 when she went to Washington to be to work
she
for the
taught, yeah.
National Endowment.
Oh, that's right. She was at the National Endowment Literature Program, and mm-hmm. then she was at the University of Maryland. She was there in 64, or were you there in 64?
In 1964, she was still the editor. Mm. I took over in 1966.
I remember writing to her, and she was extremely helpful and life-giving to me. And I think that that's the best thing an editor can be to a young poet.
Well, I couldn't agree more. It's very hard to find encouragement as a young poet, and I took my job very seriously, and I read every manuscript myself. I had no assistance.
And you had started to get lots of prizes. You started to get oodles of prizes, as we say. Poetry Magazine, my gosh, you must have half a dozen from Poetry Magazine. You won every award in the book.
No. I've been nominated for, I think, just about everyone, but the Lilly Prize is the only major one I've actually won.
Well, I have some that are lined up here around the table that I won't read, but I think you are a little bit too modest. So we'll just go with the things that you feel comfortable with, and they are the poems. So let's hear another one. This is David Wagoner, and I'm Grace Cavalieri, and he did win a bunch of prizes.
All right. In a greenhouse. Nurserymen tell us trees grown under glass in the calm of a greenhouse are spindlier, their trunks more modest, more inclined to bend under the burdens of new leaves and branches, their ordinarily haphazard outgrowth unbalanced in the direction of sunlight exclusively, taking no part in the play of weather outside the windows. Inside, trees that have grown accustomed to constant temperature and easygoing air become much less sturdy than wild ones subjected to sudden changes, surprises of much, too little, or too late. Yet their caretakers behind glass have discovered if they hold the privileged ones in hand and shake them, even pound them with padded mallets, they straighten, stiffen, and grow tall.
Tell me about the form on that poem and how you decided to go in the pattern that you've chosen. Just very briefly, in a couple
Hard
of sentences.
To tell.
Yeah.
I tried this in a longer line. It's in a short line, a staggered margin now, and I don't know, it slowed down the voice. It made it more deliberate. It made it a little chillier. A little more knowing and less casual.
Well, that's important because I don't think that the general public knows enough about what line lengths do to a poem to really tell the reader how to read it.
I don't think the most poets
know.
Do either. And that includes me because I keep switching back and forth as I revise often and often make the wrong decision and change my mind 2 weeks later. So after, it's not easy.
I have much evidence here about your awards, and I'm not going to call you on them, but did you or did you not win the Sherwood Anderson Award for Fiction?
Yes, okay. I did.
Did you or did you not win the Charles Angoff Prize for the Literary Review?
Yes, I did.
Did you? Okay, enough said. I don't think that I'm going to stand for it.
I won the William Stafford Memorial Prize,
absolutely,
too.
Absolutely, and so many, so many literary awards, that the Blumenthal, Levitin, and Blonder Prize.
Okay. Poetry Magazine has been very generous with me. I've won 6 of their yearly prizes.
And were you or were you not the Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets?
I was for 23 years. If this is bragging time, I have had more poems published in Poetry Magazine than any other poet, living or dead.
And I think that is our oldest magazine.
Yes.
1906 or something.
It was established in 1912.
Oh, Harriet Munro.
Mm-hmm.
And still absolutely, I guess, the top of the water mark here. So we're with David Wagoner. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're partly reminiscing, partly reminding him of his poetry awards and not letting him get away with anything, and mostly listening to new poems. This is a big honor for us because this is premier poetry, guys. Nobody else in the world has heard it, and you're here, and here's David.
Notes made while chaperoning a high school dance with the help of Animal Behavior by John Alcock. Pair bonding begins with individual displays at a distance. Each one takes into account the poise or the show of indifference and the exact degree of perfection in the arrangement and colors of feathers or fur. And the energy in the movement and restless stirring of wings or paws while the couple remains apart. This is followed by physical approaches in several of many forms of what could be called dances as they pass through an uncertain to a certain tolerance of each other's presence. The distance between them narrows. Then soon, quite soon, they both will show a willingness to accept direct contact. This sequence of courtship has been designed by nature to control the dangers of male aggression, to synchronize male and female agreement and toleration, which provide the basis for mutual preparations for what may yet be postponed for another time or season, the rearing of offspring.
David Wagoner, I see you're back to staggering your stanzas from the margin and then indented, 3, 4, 3, 4. And that gives you a breathing poem, a living thing. It's very funny. I just had a poem, I had to write an occasional poem for a wedding, and it was a typeset by hand, each type, and he couldn't find enough E's, so he had to stagger my poems just to get the letters in. I know that's not why you did it, but he said, do you have to write a poem with so many E's in it? And I said, oh, darn, I'll try to do better next time.
It's the commonest letter in the English language.
David, really?
Sure, all cryptographers know that.
Wow. I didn't know that. Good. Let's have another poem. We'll decode it. We'll break your code.
Okay. Here's another one, not in my own voice. Further my claim earlier that it's not wrong to do it. Abandon ship. This is your captain speaking. Your ship is sinking. Everything that has kept you afloat and moving forward day and night, regardless of waves and currents, in spite of wind, is no longer watertight. It has suffered severe damage beyond our control. It has lost power. Whether you're standing, sitting, or lying down, everything over you or around you or under you has lost its trim, is beginning to rack and list, to give in to disorderly elements under different command. The crew, for all I know, may be standing by to arrange for lifeboat seating. If not, with your flotation device, jump over the nearest rail to windward. Whatever burns will float downwind. Your legs and fingers crossed to deflect the thwarts of loose debris. If you should rise again, avoid the living and large. They are likely to be more violent than the water. And cling to what may be small and inanimate, since it's more likely to share your wish to stay above the surface of this event. You are not called upon to go down with the ship, unlike some I could mention.
The instructional poetry of David Wagoner. He is accused of sometimes giving good directions in very good poetry. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're on The Poet and the Poem.